1 Corinthians 7:7-9, the 19th talk in a series on 1 Corinthians, was presented by Ron Julian on July 21, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
My standard warning that the material in this chapter, it centers around married sexuality, so I put it at a PG-13. I also repeat my comment from last week that this is a section that is difficult to understand. It has a lot of little decisions that have to be made along the way. If I'm right in the direction that I'm going, this is a section that has been largely misunderstood in the church. The ideas that people have come away from this section with have tended to sort of paint a picture that Paul thought that marriage was definitely an inferior second best, that you should only get involved with if you don't have the personal integrity and strength to do otherwise. And I think that's far from his intent. That's not what's going on here. And I would remind you as we start out that what we looked at last time, the theme in this section, Paul is addressing a question, or really a series of issues that center around one question that he has been asked by the Corinthians. And it has to do with, they have gotten this idea that some of them have, that there is something beneficial, something more spiritual about abstaining from sexual relations. They look at Paul and his celibacy, and they know that he, perhaps they do know that he sees some benefits in a celibate life, and they are taking that and running with it to the extent that, as we saw in the first example, the issue in the first section, I believe, is there are married people, married couples, where one of the people in the marriage has decided that they are above sexuality, they are going to be hyper-spiritual and stay away from it, and they've created the situation where the other spouse has found themselves in a marriage and yet living a celibate life. And so the first issue that he addresses is, no, that's not what marriage is all about. It's very important, I think, for us to understand that everything that Paul says in this section is speaking to this perspective, that there is something better about abstaining from sexual relations. He's going to talk about divorce in this section, but the issue centers around couples splitting up because they think that it is superior to be celibate and so on. The whole section is addressing, Paul, how are your views on celibacy to be related to all of these situations where we have people who are married, or people who are married to unbelievers, or people who are engaged? What should they do? I mean, we have picked up this idea that sexuality is a second-rate option, and that the person who is shooting for spirituality will avoid it. So what should we do in all of these situations? And what Paul's coming along is providing a different basis for making that decision. So, verse 7, in your translation, in my translation, in the New American Standard, it treats it as if it belongs to the previous section. It starts with the word yet, and it seems to understand it basically as Paul has been saying, it's okay to get married. I will make the concession that you can get married, yet the better thing would be I wish everyone would be even as I myself am. That's not what's happening here, I think. I think if we were going to put the little paragraph break in, it should be here. This is not a comment about what he has just been saying, but it is a comment that he's making to move on to his next statement. So So let me read you that section. Now I wish that all people were even as I myself am. However, each has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. But I say to the unmarried and to widows that it is good for them if they remain even as I. But if they do not have self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn. Okay, this is a very famous section here, and I think if I were to characterize what I have heard people think Paul is saying, it would be something like that, something like this. It is my deepest wish that everyone were unmarried as I am, because, as I will explain later on, single people are undistracted in their devotion to the Lord. Unfortunately, not everyone has the ability to achieve this superior state as I do. So I say to those who are unmarried that it would be much better for them to remain unmarried. But if they unfortunately cannot control themselves, and they are so burning with passion that regrettably they have no power to refrain from having sex, the solution to such strong desires is to get married. Marriage, although it is an inferior way to live, is much better than burning with unrequited passions. Okay, now I make it sound kind of silly, but that's basically what I've heard that this passage says. And you can understand that. It sort of sounds like that's what he's saying. So, but I think that has misconstrued all of the pieces in this section, that Paul is getting at something else. So let me talk about the pieces and see if I can explain what I think is happening here. Let me start with this phrase. He says, each has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. I think that's the place to start, because there's this common view of that phrase. We all know, we have this idea that there's this concept of spiritual gifts in the Bible, and that what we mean by a gift is a power, an ability that I have been given from God. In fact, I think it is probably the discussion of spiritual gifts in the Bible that has led to the language that we have now regularly, where we talk about our gifts. You know, we say, oh, well, it's a gift. Meaning, I have this ability, and there's a little touch of modesty in that it was given to me, but basically the idea is I have this ability. You know, I have these gifts. And so people tend to read that into this section, the idea that if you have the gift of singleness, what it means is you have this ability to be single. Not everyone has the ability, but you happen to have it. And if we talk about the ability to be single in the context, basically how we end up interpreting that is you have a supernatural disinterest in sex. And so what you're supposed to do is look at yourself and decide whether you have the gift of singleness. And you do that by deciding whether, in fact, you're interested in sexuality or not. And if you find that you happen to be uninterested, then you have the gift of singleness. And if you happen to be interested, then I guess you don't have the gift of singleness. Now, maybe that's a strong way of putting it, but, I mean, that's the way I've heard people talking. Well, I don't think that's what he's getting at. That's not the issue here. If we weren't to import into this that this idea that somehow he's talking about this ability that we have been given, when he talks about singleness and marriage and says one person has a gift of one sort and another has a gift of another sort, I think just commonsensically we would look at that and think the word gift is a positive term. It's talking about a good thing that has been given to me. Therefore, what we would naturally think here, if we weren't bringing in this idea somehow that we've gotten somewhere, is that to be single is a good gift from God, and to be married is a good gift from God. It is the state itself that is the gift. Are you a single person? There is something good about being single, and therefore it is a gift from God to you. Are you a married person? There is something good about marriage, and therefore it is a gift of God to you. I think that's crucially important to understand. The other way of understanding that, that kind of downplays, everyone has his own gift, But we end up interpreting that as if he's saying, some of us have the gift of being able to control ourselves, and others have the gift of lacking self-control and having to get married so they don't sin. Which is crazy. I mean, that's not what he's talking about. He's saying there are these two gifts. Singleness is a good gift, and marriage is a good gift. Well, if that's the case, which I think is very, very likely that it is what he means, then this helps us to get perspective on what he says when he says, now I wish that all people were even as I myself am. I think he does mean, he's talking about being unmarried, living a celibate life. And he says, I wish that all people were even as myself, I myself am. What he's saying is, he is really truly expressing in this case not his command, not even his belief that the world would be better off if no one were married. He is genuinely expressing his personal preference. And what makes that clear is that he basically goes on to say, he says, I prefer singleness, but God does not agree with me. The fact is that God has two kinds of gifts that he gives. It is not God's intention to have the world filled with single people. And of course you could understand that the world wouldn't be filled very long if it was filled with single people. But he has these two kinds of gifts that he has to give. So I think we have to understand Paul is saying here, I like the gift that I have been given. I like the single life. Not just it suits my lifestyle. I mean, he's going to say later on what it is that he thinks is advantageous about being single. And we're not going to talk about that today because there's a whole big discussion later on in the chapter, and I'm going to save it for that, which will also give me another week to think about what he's saying in that section. And I could answer the question now, but I will feel a lot more confident about it if I get to think about it a little more. So I can wait on that. But the idea here is, look, you guys, the Corinthians that he's talking to, I'm not against the idea. I agree. There is something good. Like we said at the beginning, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Yeah, there is something good about celibacy. I agree with you guys about that. But you have to understand that it is not God's intention to say that it is the preferred option in the sense that that is the good gift and marriage is some sort of unfortunate compromise. They are both good gifts from God. I wish that everyone were as myself am. I find where I am to be a good place. But God has different gifts. Now, this seems to me to be essential to understand this that he's saying here, because it helps us in everything that we see in this section from this verse on to help us realize that he is not knocking marriage or calling it second best in this section. He's not saying that marriage is what you do if you don't have the power to do the good thing. That's not what he's saying. He's saying there are these two gifts, and there is something good about being unmarried, but there is this other gift that God gives, and there's something good about that as well. That we have to see that, or otherwise I think we miss, as often is done, we miss Paul's overall perspective here. What he says in this section is all colored by the fact that he's speaking into a situation where people have this idea that sexuality is something to be avoided if you want to be spiritual. And what he's trying to do is say, there is something good about celibacy, and we'll talk about that, but you have the wrong idea if you think that there's something bad about sexuality. And that's kind of the balance that he's trying to maintain in the section, I think. I mean, I don't know, maybe this isn't a good analogy, but it strikes me that the way he's using the word wish here, where he says, I wish this, is not unlike what he does in Romans, where he says that he wishes he could trade his salvation in in order to save the Jews. I wish that I could be accursed in order that they might be saved. Well, I don't think he's saying that that's in fact what I want to happen or expect to happen or I'm going to pursue. He's expressing his heart. This is how I feel about it. When I think about their situation, the feelings I have are that I wish I could somehow sacrifice myself in order to save them. Is that going to happen? No, that's not the way it's going to happen. But this is how I feel. I think it's kind of that sort of sense of wish here. What he's saying is, there's something about this state that I have this sense that I wish that I could give you what I have. But the fact is, that's not the way God works. God knows what he's doing, and he has gifts of different sorts to give to people. Okay. So, that's his general comment, I think. What he's getting at here is he's not saying singleness is superior. He's saying, I have a personal recognition that in my life it is a good thing, and I wish others could share it. But God has different sorts of gifts to give. Now, he has said this, I think, leading into this next statement, but I say to the unmarried and to widows that it is good for them if they remain even as I. See what he just said. I wish that everyone could be as I am. Now, so let me tell you here's what I would say to the unmarried and to widows. It's good if they stay, that they remain in the state that they are, just as I am. Remain single. Now, it's hard to be definitive here, but I would vote at this point that it's actually a little more restrictive than it sounds. If he says, I say to the unmarried and to widows, it sounds like he's saying, I'm saying to all unmarried people, and I'm saying to widows. But of course, if you think about it, widows are unmarried people. And why pick them out? Why not say something to widowers? Or, I mean, what's the deal? I would understand here that we should actually think of the word unmarried basically as if it were the word widowers. That he's saying unmarried men and widows, and what he basically has in mind is, I'm talking to men and women who have been married before. Further on down the line, he's going to talk about the situation where people are engaged, where they are not married, but they are engaged to be married or thinking about being engaged to be married and that sort of thing. But right now, we're talking, I think the whole first section is talking to married people of various sorts. If you're married, then sexuality is intended for marriage. If you were married, but now you're not, so you are a person who has been living a life that involved a sexual relationship with your spouse, and now you are not married, what should you do? That's the group that he turns to next, as I understand it. Now, I wouldn't stake anything hugely important on my having identified that right, but that's what I would vote at this point. I think that's what he's doing. Makes the best sense out of all the categories. And this word unmarried here was used at times to refer to widowers, so I think that's what he has in mind. Okay, now he says, his advice to them is it is good for them to remain even as I. Now, what sense good? This is the same good as when he says it is good for a man not to touch a woman before. He's not saying it's morally good. He's not saying that the superior moral option is for them to remain unmarried. I don't think he's saying that it's God's best. He's not saying that the best thing would be, if you really want to follow God and do what he really wants you to do, you won't marry. I think he is saying just what it sounds like. He's saying, there is a good. As I said, I could wish that everyone were like me. So what I would say to people who have been married but are not married now is, I think you would do well to stay as you are. That's how I think about it. That's what I would do. But he has a qualification that he wants to put on that. And he's saying, I do agree with you, Corinthians, to this extent. There is a good. It can be beneficial and worthwhile for the widows and widowers to remain unmarried, to be single just as I am. After all, I find advantages to that life, and so I think it would be good for them to share in those advantages. At this point, this is Paul agreeing a little bit with this group in Corinth that would, see, they would agree. You know, if you're not married, don't get married, because they would say, stay away from sexuality altogether. The superior option is to stay away from it. Well, Paul's saying, okay, yeah, I can see there's a good, I'll go along with the idea that it'd be a good idea to remain unmarried for reasons that he'll talk about later. But I'm not saying not to get married. I'm not saying that there's something wrong with getting married in this situation. Later on, he's going to talk about that more, and he uses the famous line about how let them marry, they do not sin. Why is he talking in that way? He's talking in that way because he's talking to a group of people who have the idea that sexuality is something inferior, such that to choose it is really to choose against God somehow. He's saying no. Yeah, so I would say to the unmarried and to the widows that it is good for them to remain as I, but now here's where it gets tricky, and this is where I think people have misunderstood what Paul's getting at. My translation says, if they do not have self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn. It seems to me that there are two mistakes that get made as people read that, two ideas that we come away from this with that I think are not what Paul intends. The first mistake is that he's saying that the only godly reason to get married is if you are such a slave of your passions that you cannot keep yourself from sinning sexually. You lack self-control. Obviously, self-control is a good thing. Self-control is even a fruit of the Spirit. But if you don't have it, if you just cannot control yourself in this manner, which is obviously a bad thing, then you'll have to take the inferior road of getting married. I think that's a misunderstanding of what he's saying. And the second misunderstanding that comes out of this is that because of that, we see Paul as giving the advice, if you have no self-control and cannot keep yourself from sinning sexually, the solution is marriage. The idea is, if you are a person who is struggling with sexual temptations in your life, the problem will be solved if you get married. The problem is that many, many people have looked at this advice and wondered what Paul was getting at, and it seemed like Paul must be sort of naive about how these things work. Because the fact is, if a person is struggling with sexual temptation, the fact is that marriage is oftentimes not a cure for the problem. You bring yourself into your marriage. You're still the same person you were before you got married when you get married. It's just that now, instead of your sexual behavior affecting just yourself, you now have a spouse that is affected by it as well. But the idea that somehow marriage is this officially sanctioned way to provide physical release that will solve the problem of sexual temptation, we get that idea from this passage, that that's what Paul is suggesting. It's better to marry than to burn. How do you solve the problem? Get married, then that'll solve the problem. I don't think that either of those things is exactly what he's getting at here. Now, I admit, this is a tricky passage. There are many tricky passages in this section, but let me say this first of all. Do not have self-control. If you do not have self-control, I think that's probably not a good translation of this. You knew I was going to say that, right? But the fact is that this word, I can't find evidence that this word ever particularly means that. To talk about the ability to control yourself, the issue being, do I have the power to control myself, or am I somehow a slave of my passions and unable to keep myself from doing things? That's not really what this word means. The word means to exercise self-control, to discipline oneself, to limit oneself, to abstain. I mean, that's what the word means. It means to abstain, to exercise self-control, to be disciplined and control what I do and don't do. Later in 1 Corinthians, Paul uses this word again, where he talks about the athlete who is preparing to compete in the games, exercises self-control in all things. He's not talking about his power, he's talking about his choice. He chooses to discipline himself. I have a goal that I am pursuing. I want to win the crown. So I choose not to do certain things and to do other things that may be difficult because I have this goal in mind. And in that later section, Paul says, in essence, that we ought to be choosing to live our lives in such a way that we have the goal of our own salvation in mind. So that's, it's a different context and a different issue. He's not particularly talking about sexuality there. He's just making this analogy. Well, what I wanted to show you is that the word has to do with, as I understand it, the choice to discipline oneself, the choice to limit oneself and choose a certain disciplined course of action, to not go a certain place instead of going there. So I think what he's doing here is that he is saying, he's not saying, don't get married unless you cannot possibly control yourself. You have no ability to control yourself. He's saying this, I agree that not touching a woman, that is, remaining single as I am, can be a good thing. But if you do not choose to abstain, if you do not choose to discipline yourself and not get married, if you do not choose to not touch a woman in this way, then get married. Because it is better to be married. What you do not want to do is listen to the people around you and decide that sexuality is somehow an option that is not for the spiritual people, and so choose not to get married because you think somehow that being unmarried is a better spiritual choice. But you are a person who has not decided, has not made that commitment to being disciplined with your sexuality. So here you are, you're not married, but you have not really made that commitment to being a sexually disciplined person, so you've fallen into the worst spot. You're not married, but you haven't made that commitment to being single either. I think that's what he's getting at. He's saying, if you do not choose to abstain, if you do not choose to limit yourself in this way, then fine, great. If you don't make that choice, then what do? Get married. Because it is better to marry than to burn. Now, that's a very difficult passage. I think what he has in mind there is it is better to choose marriage, to decide to be a married person, than to think yourself superior to it and choose not to be married and then burn with illicit passions. Basically be a person who is driven by sexual desire, living that out however that might be, perhaps sometimes going to the temple prostitutes in Corinth as happened there. Think, no. Your choices, the good choices that are in front of you, are to choose to live a celibate life for the good reasons that go with that, or to choose to be married for the good reasons that go with that. What you don't want to do is be an uncelibate, unmarried person. That's what I think he's describing here. And if that's true, then he's not saying that the only reason that one might have to get married is that you can't control yourself. He's just confronting them with this either-or choice. You can choose to be as I am and remain unmarried, or you can get married. But you don't have another option. There isn't a third option there for you. If you're going to talk about being a spiritual person and following God, God has those two choices in front of you. You can embrace singleness or you can embrace marriage, but you don't have a third option. Now, I recognize that that's a difficult section, and I'm quite willing to be talked out of that into another perspective on it, but that's what makes sense to me right now. Okay. Now, he moves on then. I'm going to drop that for a minute then. He moves on to a new group. We have a whole different set of circumstances that he keeps addressing. In the light of this question that you guys have asked me, you Corinthians have asked me, what would I say? People are married. It's not a good idea to decide that you're above sexuality if you're a married person. That is not what marriage is all about. You have made a commitment to your spouse. If you are unmarried, if you are a widower or widow, where you are looking at the question of, should I get married again? If I were to make that choice, I would not do it. I would not get married again. But nothing wrong with that. If you choose not to pursue that course and limit yourself in that way, then my advice would be, get married. Okay? Now we come to another group. To the married, I give instructions, not I, but the Lord, that the wife should not leave her husband. But if she does leave, let her remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband, and that the husband should not send his wife away. Okay, well now when I say it's another group, it's another group in a certain sense. The first group that he was talking to is married people who, because of what they're hearing in Corinth, have one or the other has decided that they are above sexuality. Here, we're talking about married people who have gotten to the point where they, in light of this discussion that's happening in Corinth, have decided that they are so above sexuality that it would be best to part. Right, okay, Paul is right. We're not going to live together as roommates. That's not an option. That's not a good idea. We're going to split. We're going to go our separate ways. I would understand this section to be not Paul's speaking to the issue of divorce in general. He's not coming along and answering the question, is it okay for us to get divorced? Because this is in a context. The question is, how do we handle this situation where people are thinking that sexuality is an unspiritual option? What he's saying here is, what you do not have the option of doing is splitting up. That is, if you want to do what is right in this situation, then my instructions are that the wife should not leave her husband, and if she does leave, she should remain unmarried, and that the husband should not send his wife away. Okay, now, he says, not I, but the Lord. What does he mean by that? I think what he means is, in this case, you Corinthians who are thinking, oh, I know what we'll do. We'll just split up. That's how we'll solve the problem. He's saying, you already have teaching from Jesus, from the Lord, and he means Jesus here, I think, that would tell you what you ought to be thinking about that. Jesus taught about marriage that a man and wife have been made one flesh by God. They have been made one life together. He's already talked about that a little bit earlier on. The idea that the two people have come together and they are sharing their lives, God has made them one life together, and that includes the physical sharing of their bodies that is a part of marriage. And, therefore, we should not split what God has joined. And for me to decide to split from this person so I can marry this person over here is tantamount to committing adultery. That is, it doesn't change the fact. The Pharisees had the idea that because Moses had given them a commandment that included the idea of divorce, they had the idea that as long as they went through the procedure, they could be considered to be righteous before God. I don't want to be married to her anymore. I want to be married to her. If I were to sleep with her and not her, I would be committing adultery because I'm married to her. So I know what I'll do. I'll divorce her. Moses said you can do that. Now I'll marry this one over here. See? I get what I want, and I'm still legal. I've still followed the rules. Well, it's that mindset, I think, that Jesus is speaking into and saying, no. I mean, that's just as it is adultery of a kind to lust after a woman in your heart, it is adultery of a kind to divorce one person so you can go marry somebody else. It's the same thing. I know that legally it's not the same thing, but the heart of it is the same thing. So Paul, I think, he's taking off from Jesus' instructions to the Pharisees in that situation, his response to their attitude towards divorce. And he's not speaking into the same situation. It's not quite the same deal here. People aren't thinking the same thing. The issue in Corinth is we're thinking that marriage is an inferior state. And so we wish we hadn't gotten married because the truly spiritual person would not be married. Okay, you're saying we can't live together and not have a sexual relationship. That's not what marriage is for. Okay, so let's split. Let's take it apart. Well, what he's saying is, Jesus has already spoken to that. You have been united by God. So, his instructions to them are, first of all, no, you're not going to solve this problem by dissolving the marriage. What God has joined, let no man take apart. Jesus made that very clear. So that's not, you're not going to tell me that that's a righteous option. And if she does leave, and in this situation the irony is she would be leaving because supposedly being unmarried is the superior option, then she had certainly better not get remarried. I mean, here supposedly she's taking the superior road of being unmarried, and then she goes off and marries somebody else. I mean, Jesus has spoken to both of those things. God has joined you together, so how could you possibly think that God thinks it's better for you, it's more spiritual for you to be apart, and certainly if you go apart, then you had better not get married again, because remember what Jesus said about that stuff. That's what I understand Paul to be doing here. He's giving a situational set of instructions. He's speaking into the situation where they are deciding that it would be the superior option to separate. Okay. Now, I'm not going to go into the next section yet because I have a few things to say in conclusion, and then I want to leave time for some questions. But notice the next group that he goes on to, he says, but to the rest, I say, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, let him not send her away. Again, this is not Paul saying, let me give you all of the marriage rules. Let me give you all of the rules on divorce. He's speaking into their situation where certainly, okay, think about if being married, being in a sexual relationship with another person is somehow the unspiritual option, then think about all the different ways they might be thinking about this. Okay, we're married, let's abstain. We're widowed, let's stay unmarried. We're married and we can't stay together because that's not going to work. Okay, let's dissolve the marriage. Okay, now how about this? I'm married to somebody and that other person isn't even a Christian. Now you're going to tell me that there's something holy about that? You're going to tell me something that you could be a righteous person and engage in sexual relations with a person that doesn't belong to Jesus? How could that be? So again, he's got these various situations that he's speaking to where their thought is that somehow the driving principle is that sexuality is some sort of a tainting, unrighteous sort of option that you want to find a way of keeping away from. And so one of the things he's going to go on to address, and we'll talk about it next time, is this idea that well, if I'm married to an unbeliever, certainly that would be reason to split up here, because that, I mean, if you want to talk about the pollution that's coming to me, that's got to be pollution, right? And so we'll talk about that next time. But I hope you can see what's happening here. He's got these different situations, all of which revolve around this opening statement that he makes: it is good for a man not to touch a woman. That's what the Corinthians are thinking. It is good for a man not to touch a woman. And therefore, they have pushed that into all sorts of arenas. And he wants to go and look at those and say, okay, well, let's moderate this. Let's think about what this would mean. Okay, a couple of concluding comments on this issue of the gift of singleness that he addresses there. Like I said, I think it is a mistake to try to figure out, to see this as somehow, I look at myself to see whether I have been supernaturally empowered to be single. And if I don't see the evidence of it, then I don't have the gift of singleness and I had better get married. Part of the problem that this creates, and this happens with a lot of our view of spiritual gifts, the idea out there in the church is that I have been gifted with these various abilities, and my job is to find out what they are and then to make sure that I go out and have the opportunity to live in accordance with them, to exercise those gifts. Well, what happens in that environment is it's a surefire recipe, and I've seen it happen many times, for a kind of a baptized discontent. Look, God gave me this gift, and yet I'm not having the opportunity to do it. I've decided that he gave me the gift of teaching, but I'm not teaching. My job is, you know, working over at the fire station or something like that. And obviously a great travesty has occurred. I'm supposed to be doing this, and yet I'm doing this other thing because my gift is this, but unfortunately I'm doing this. I hear in the Christian community language that says, there's this great tragedy in my life because I don't have the gift of singleness, but I'm single. I think that is an inaccurate, as I understand it, that's not the way to understand how Paul is using this language. Not that there's anything wrong with desiring to be married. There's nothing wrong at all with desiring to be married. But it is that discontent that says, I have a right to be discontented, because God didn't give me the gift of singleness, and yet somehow the universe has been mismanaged, and I am single. This is an awful situation. That, I think, is an inappropriate way of applying this. What I need to look at is, while I am single, that is my gift. And there is something to be valued in that while I have it. Even if ultimately I would desire to be married, the fact is that I have a gift in the singleness that I have. Now, what is the nature of that gift? As Paul sees it, he's going to discuss that later on. But I think the appropriate way to think about this is not, I have a right to be bummed out because I'm not living in accordance with my gift, but rather, this is the gift that I have, and so let me deal with it while I have it. Then, the other comment I wanted to make, and this is too big a topic, but I'm not really prepared to go here, but I just wanted to comment on this, what Paul says about divorce there. In essence, what he's talking about, I would argue, is not the overall subject of divorce. He's talking about, what would I say to a situation where you have decided that it is good for a man not to touch a woman, and so somebody's going to split here to achieve this end. Saying, no, that is not an option. That's not the way God made things to be. Is what Paul's saying here, is it addressing the situation, my husband is beating me up? And Paul says, well, the Lord has told you that you should not leave your husband. I don't think that's the way the Bible has put this together. But I don't think that he's saying, therefore, that if a marriage has come to the place where it is no longer a marriage and divorce happens, that therefore both of the people involved in the marriage have committed some sin. And I definitely don't think that the teaching on divorce in the Bible is intended to separate divorce out as being some special kind of thing. I mean, I think it's very striking that Jesus gives one of his teachings on divorce in the section where he's talking to the Pharisees about, you have heard it said, do not commit adultery. And he goes on and gives these two examples, lusting after a woman in your heart and divorcing and marrying someone else. He gives both of them and saying, in essence, they are adultery. So he's saying to the Pharisees, don't you dare come along and say that you're righteous people because you haven't committed adultery with anyone, when you are people who lust after women in your hearts and regularly approve, some of you do, divorcing one person so you can go marry another. In both cases, he's saying the heart is adulterous, even though the activity of adultery hasn't actually happened. But he is not saying there, I mean, look at it in those terms. Yes, there is sin that happens, but it's not the unforgivable sin. I mean, he's pairing it with committing adultery by lusting after a woman in your heart. And to my knowledge, it's pretty much 100% when we're talking about, I mean, everybody in their heart, somewhere along the line, is going to probably find themselves violating God's commandment to be content and to not covet what is not theirs and to lust after someone else. Is it evil? Yes. And what God wants us to do is recognize that there is something wrong with that situation. But is it the unforgivable sin? No. I mean, the fact is, this is the reality that we have to face about ourselves. Well, likewise, I think Jesus is saying, Moses gave you divorce because of the hardness of your hearts. People's hearts are hard, and sometimes people are evil enough that a marriage comes to the place where it cannot be sustained, and so he allowed for divorce. Jesus isn't coming along and saying Moses was wrong. He shouldn't have done that because it's evil. He's saying, no, the reason for divorce is not to provide you a sanctioned way to go marry somebody else. It is because of the hardness of your hearts. When a marriage falls apart, which has to be because of evil, I mean, it cannot be that there hasn't been evil that has led to this situation, then it is the hardness of your hearts that makes it so Moses made a provision in the law for divorce. So my point here is, rather than seeing passages like this as, aha, here's the rule book on marriage. We've got Jesus saying this, we've got Paul saying this, we put them together and here are the rules, and if you violate these, then you're this evil person that we have to not associate with. What they're saying, what Jesus was saying is, you Pharisees cannot justify yourselves by saying, oh, it's okay, I divorced her. And what Paul is saying is, you cannot think that you're being spiritual by staying away from that nasty sex stuff and parting from your spouse. In both cases, you are not living in accordance with what God made things to be. God made marriage to last. And that, in both cases, you're not doing the right thing, you're doing the wrong thing in pursuing that. But neither of those passages is speaking to the situation. I mean, what is a person to do if they find themselves, their spouse has left them, their spouse has been unfaithful to them, their spouse is beating up on them? Is the Bible saying the righteous thing to do is to not even leave, to stay there and get beat up? I don't find any evidence that that's what the Bible is saying. That's not the perspective it's taking, I think. So on the one hand, it has a very strong statement about the sanctity of marriage and the evil of divorce, because divorce is always evil. But at the same time, I don't think it's saying that, therefore, divorce will never happen in the life of a person who is trying to follow God, if that makes any sense. Probably doesn't, because we have to go and talk about those other passages to put it together. But unfortunately, it seems to me that in the church today, we have put a very high premium on the rule about divorce, and we have a very low view of the sanctity of marriage, which it seems to me the Bible's perspective is the other way around. It has a very high view of the sanctity of marriage, but it is not a rule-based system. It's not saying you divorce someone and you've lost your salvation or something like that. The question is, where I am right now, given the situation that I am facing, what would God have me do? And what we know is, He would not have me divorce this person so I can go marry the person I really want to be married to, and He would not have me divorce this person so that I can be a single person and be free from that yucky sex stuff. That's not what God wants. We know that for certain. Because the general principle is, what God has joined, let no one take apart. You can't justify it and say it. It must be what God wants, because it would be the righteous and spiritual thing to do. It can't be what God wants in that sense, because He put you together. You have been made one. Okay, so I yapped on and on. We should take a minute anyway for any comments or questions you might have.
I see in the church today a historically unprecedented level of singleness.
Yes.
It seems to me that, as I observe myself and others, that is the result of sin and emotional damage, maybe even economic factors, rarely. It doesn't seem to be the result of God determining suddenly to gift a whole generation of singleness. So what is the difference between that and the gift?
Okay.
In that perspective?
Okay. What you're talking about, I think, I want to say, I don't think you're saying, and I would not say, that we can identify all the sinners in the group here. Let's see, everybody who's single, raise your hand. Okay, is it sin that led to this? So, but I know what you're talking about. I mean, I speak from my own situation. I didn't marry until I was 25 years old, having met the woman that I would marry 7 years before. And the reason that I did not get married for those 7 years was out of fear. Fear of commitment, fear of the responsibility of marriage and all of that. I mean, very, very clear in my situation. I had absolutely no doubt that this woman was the one. She and I both knew that sometimes it happens that way. It just did for us. There was no question. We weren't looking for anybody else or anything like that. Robbie just had the misfortune to get stuck with a guy who could not get his act together. So I think that the fact that didn't marry until 7 years later was a result of sin, my sin. I mean, my fears. And when I finally decided to get married, I understood that issue. I've told many of you this story before, but I went on a retreat with the pastors of Peninsula Bible Church, where I was working at the time. And I had in mind that I really needed to think through this. It was time for me to come to terms with this stuff. So I had my own personal agenda on this trip. But one of the things that struck me is although there were theological differences that ultimately parted us from PBC, there were some really mature, godly men in that group. And I really admired their courage, the way they lived their lives, the way they took responsibility for the people around them, the difficult situations they faced. I really admired the courage that I saw in them that I did not see in myself, frankly. And And it really, I really found myself thinking about that a lot over that weekend, that I had every reason to think that I should marry Robbie, and I had every reason to think that God was faithful, and that if there were difficulties in marriage, which there are, that God would be faithful, and it would be a good thing. However, whether it was difficult or not, God was one to be trusted. So yeah, I think just on that issue, and maybe on a number of issues, there in our culture, there is a propensity towards self-absorption and fears and those kinds of things that have led to an unusually high rate of singleness. That may be the case. I don't know whether that's what's led to it, but let's just suppose for the sake of argument that you're right and that some of that is what has led to the situation. See, I understand the gift of singleness here differently. It is the state of being single that he's talking about. So it may be that I am in the state of being single for bad reasons on my own part, and that those fears need to be addressed. And it doesn't mean that I'm supposed to get married, but it means that I certainly need to confront the question of whether I trust God and all of that kind of stuff. But the fact is that my place in life, I have the life of a single person. And Paul is going to say there are certain advantages to that that make that life a certain kind of gift from God. So that's how I would understand it. I would say it's like saying, no, that could be misleading. No, it's not like saying that at all. So that's, I think that's how I would answer it. Roger?
It's a two-part question. Is being content with where God put you, is that a Christian virtue? And if it is, does that enter into Paul's statement, I wish you were as I am? That part of that picture is that he wishes that they would be content in the situation that they find themselves in?
Okay. Yes. Being content with my circumstances in life, being content with the life that God has given me, is very much a Christian virtue. We're going to be talking about that more. That theme is going to show up more in this section even as we go along. So that would need clarification as to exactly what we mean by being content, and is it ever appropriate to desire to change my circumstances and, you know, that sort of thing. But yes, in general, it is content. It is a virtue. And I know what you're saying. It is tempting to want to take that. It would solve the problem greatly to say, I wish that everyone were as I am, meaning I wish everyone could be content with the circumstances in which they find themselves. I don't think that quite works. And maybe it does, but I can't quite see it at this point. It seems to me that the emphasis there is the notion of as I am in the sense of being unmarried. But yes, absolutely, that's actually a key idea in this section. What he wants to say when you put this whole thing together, in a sense, is either way, it's not the biggest deal. The biggest deal has to do with my expectations as a child of the kingdom. The biggest deal is the fact that I am living as an heir of this great thing that God is doing. I would say that's what he's going to go on to talk about. That's the biggest deal. So in a sense, it's neither here nor there. If you're worried about this choice, oh my gosh, you know, should we stay away from this or not stay away from it and so on, there's kind of a bottom line where he wants to say, it's okay. I mean, go either way, it's all right. Just make the most important stuff the most important stuff. So, yeah, that is an important issue. Bill, did you have your hand up?
I've heard you talk before about the way Paul used the word gift in Romans. And I found it helpful to think of it there as a rule. You know, and so I'm thinking, even when I was at the beginning part of when you were teaching, thinking about the word gift and thinking, okay, I'm still sort of confused about that. Should I substitute in my mind just the word role? And it seems like as you're talking about it, you know, if I find myself single, that's my role. If I find myself married, that's my role. Is that a helpful way to...
As meaning a good thing that God has given me. Get in singleness is not a curse. It is a gift. And so on. I see kid action happening out there that tells me I've gone too long, which I have, so I think we should probably stop at this point.